It's always that first word. And then, let's see, where does it go? Yeah, in some ways, our journey through life is a lot like that. Like that first step or first movement towards something, and then there's the mystery. We don't know, right? We don't know where things are going to go. And coming on a retreat, you know, we don't know how it's going to unfold, and there's a lot of kind of that mystery. How is it going to be? I'm curious for you, for any of you, has the day gone the way that you had planned? And who is living the life that they had scripted? Did anyone script out their life when they were young and now it's turned out that way? Did anyone? I'm really curious. I would love to know if it's possible. I hope you didn't write this playbook, because the world is not going according to great plans. Who's ever written these plans out? The world is doing what it does, and then this day is doing what it is, and the mind and body are doing what they are doing. And what a wild ride it is to be on that journey, to be on the ride, and to be in that together. I mean, I think that's one of the remarkable things about a retreat environment, is that we are all opening to that possibility of being in some basic relationship to, right, to truth, to the way things are. And that's a powerful thing to do. It's so easy to spend our days, right, in some ways avoiding things that might be uncomfortable, or avoiding being in touch deeply with what is arising in the heart and mind. And so then we stay kind of in a treadmill, we say, constantly leaning forward, seeking something more, right, or something different. And there's just so many movements that keep us a little bit disconnected, a little bit armored. And what is it like to begin, right, this softening? You know, I don't think, you know, non-meditators, I think they, you know, they hear about us meditators, right? We are all a pack now. We're all the same thing. We're all meditators. So we are a group, and our group identity is, I don't know how do non-meditators now see us as meditators? It's like we come on these retreats, and there is food provided for us. We have, you know, comfortable enough beds, quiet environment, and maybe it's like looks like a very soft, very easy, and no suffering experience. So I'm curious, have you suffered? Anyone managed to suffer yet? And I do often like to think about just how creative we are in all the ways we can manage to suffer. And if you look kind of carefully, it's interesting, you know, because nowhere in the actual structure of the retreat could someone outside the retreat look at it and say, well, that looks really hard. Sitting and walking, that's really tough. Sit and walk, have lunch. And now, by day two, you get an open period. And it's amazing the suffering we can create from an open schedule. Quick vote, open schedule good or open schedule bad? How is it for you? Liking it? Oh, most people like it. Yeah, I mean, a lot of you are familiar at this point. So where does all this dukkha come from, this suffering? I think that's one of the, in a way, one of the key elements of this particular path that is so unique to the Dharma, is in some ways asking this basic question, you know, where does this suffering come from? And the question is really asked on a very direct and immediate part of our experience. So directly, where does our suffering, the suffering that arises, where does it come from? And I think we might look into the world and see that there's so much suffering. And the suffering of the world that is human-caused, or caused by human beings, when you trace that back, just as we might do for ourselves, when we look carefully into what is it that actually is the cause of suffering. And this was the Buddha's particular insight was, well, if you keep looking and keep staying with it, you will see where it kind of leads, where the threads lead to. And eventually, if you look at the cause and effect process, you will land right somewhere in your heart and mind. And that's a kind of powerful idea. And I think my mind easily rebels against that, you know, saying, but there's all these, you know, things that are wrong and bad about the world and, you know, and all these kind of justifications for why the mind is suffering. And yet, if it weren't the case that the suffering that we experience, if it weren't the case that it could be traced back somewhere into the heart and mind, there would be no path. Right? There would be no path towards freedom. If the suffering was truly outside of us, something that was causing or making us to be upset, irritated, angry, I think Carol was mentioning last night in a conversation with Sousa, saying, you know, this phrase that no one truly can make you angry. Angry in the sense of like burning with resentment, right? Where the mind is starting to suffer. Right? Not the clarity that knows what is right and wrong, but that burning energy. So if it wasn't, if it's not the case that there is something happening in our heart and mind, right, that is behind suffering, we would spend our entire lives trying externally to change everyone else. And it's so easy to think that everyone else, right, is, maybe not everyone, but if you have a partner or a parent, at least they have some things that if they were just to change a little bit, the world would be better off. And our relationship would work a little bit better. I do often quote this New Yorker cartoon that I just love this particular thing. So it just points to that tendency of the mind and heart. And it's showing two people clearly in sort of a domestic moment arguing. And the caption beneath it says, you know, if it doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong, why don't I be right and you be wrong? And it'd be so easy. It'd be so nice if we could just be right and just, you know, everything else is the problem. The schedule is a problem if it's sitting and walking. That's the schedule's fault. The sitting, you know, the sits are maybe too long or too short, and the bell's not being rung on time, and the mind starts to scream, like, the sitting has got to be over. Please ring the bell, for Christ's sake. Or I was just getting somewhere right when you rung the bell. Gosh, why did that have to happen? Right? Was it today that there were baked potatoes? Was that today's meal? Yummy, baked potatoes. But I still managed to suffer slightly because I was wanting 1.5 baked potatoes. And I stood there for a minute. I don't know who was near me. Maybe they saw me debating. And I was just trying to figure out if I could, how do I cut a potato in half quickly enough so I wasn't holding people up, but then also didn't look like I was obsessing over, you know, this choice of how much potato to take. Not a big suffering, but, you know, something was getting triggered and getting activated in that moment. So in a way, it's a gift, right? It's a gift to be given this this message, right, that there is something in our heart and mind that we can do, that we can do, that we can look at, that can unlock a sense of ease, a sense of okayness, an ability to be with, right, all the conditions just as they are. And this is really why in these teachings, probably most of you know these, the Four Noble Truths, why they really are called noble truths. The Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering. And that sounds like a depressing truth. Does it feel noble to you? There is suffering. You know, I do often I say that luckily the Buddha didn't perish after the first noble truth. Like, there is suffering. That's wonderful. Such good news. That's such a noble truth. It has a cause, right? And that suffering has an end. Suffering can be relinquished. Causes can be let go of. And that there's a path. And that is what we're doing. This fourth noble truth, it's called the Noble Eightfold Path, and it has path factors like mindfulness, like steadiness of mind, like wise view that Carol spoke about last night, wise thoughts or intentions, wise action, wise livelihood, wise speech. So these path factors all together are called what is called the middle way. And that's what we're doing. This middle way, this way that is not forever in a battle with conditions. The middle way that allows this life, this body, this mind, from moment to moment, to be as it is. Right? These sights, these sounds, these heartaches when they come, pains in the heart and mind, different mental states of sleepiness and doubt and confusion. How do we be with these different visitors? And I think in the beginning of our practice, it can feel a little bit like the practice is one more, like, I don't know if you've ever played that game, at least where I grew up going to the beach, there was this whack-a-mole game where these little moles would come up and you'd have this little baton and you're trying to hit them as they pop up. And it feels like trying to be happy in life is a little bit like whack-a-mole, right? Whatever kind of surfaces that's unpleasant, we whack it, right? Or we have a pain in the body and we try and get rid of it. And over time, as we continue practicing, the insights start to arise, right? That what really brings about peace, what really freedom points to, is this ability to be with conditions as they are. And this is the whole terrain of One way of calling it is wise attitude. I wanted to talk a little bit about that, about wise attitude, and how it's connected to wise view. So Carol spoke about wise view, and Nisha this morning was offering us a wonderful guided practice around wise attitude. And I sat for a while trying to figure out this connection early on when Sayadaw Tejaniya was still in his earlier days of formulating how he liked to teach or explain the mindfulness teachings. And he'd talk about wise attitude and then right views, and I was kind of not sure, and it took me a while to, in some ways, kind of sense into this kind of this understanding that view, right, wise view, which has this wisdom element, and it's in the wisdom group of the path factors. So wise view is, because it's a wisdom factor, it's a little bit more intellectual. So at first, when we hear wise views, might be that it's, you know, that whatever is happening is nature, or that it's cause and effect. Whatever experience we're having now, whatever experience we've had in the past, and whatever experience that is going to come next is arising out of conditions. So that's one way of understanding wise view, seeing things as nature. As Carol was talking about last night, our tendency, though, is to personalize. We own and possess everything. Everything that we see, everything that we feel, everything that we hear lands in the heart and mind and has a tendency to trigger reactions. Particularly when it's pleasant and unpleasant, then our reactive mind gets even stronger. And when we're really identified with the body, with the mind, anything that impinges on it, we need to escape. We want to get out of it. And there's one quick teaching just on this particular point that the Buddha called the two arrows. And he calls the untrained mind, he says about the untrained mind, after the first arrow hits of life, which is just life, the first arrow happens, the second arrow is the mind's reaction. And he says that the untrained worldling, which is basically when we don't know how to practice, the only way, he says, out of that unpleasant state is to try to run towards something a little bit more pleasant. And that's what we do. Untrained minds, when we're untrained, when we're experiencing something unpleasant and difficult, we immediately, and there's no escape other than that habit. And the problem is we can't endlessly get what we want. And then we're back into a moment of difficulty and challenge. And that's samsara. Forever kind of going from moment to moment, seeking what is pleasant, running away from what is unpleasant. And it's never ending. Never ending. When we don't have a practice. So that view, seeing things as nature, starts out as an intellectual understanding. So it's intellectual. We need to have that understanding in the beginning. Right? Everything is nature. It's cause and effect. That understanding, as we continue to bring it in an intellectual way, slowly will turn into some insights. That becomes a wisdom. The wisdom factor of the mind becomes activated. But in the beginning, we need to have this information so that we can apply it to when we're caught in a difficult emotional state, right? Something hard is happening in our experience. We're not sure what to do. And we need to use this intellectual understanding at least to begin to look at experience. How do I attend to the present moment? So that right view is in the wisdom arena. Wise attitude. And oftentimes we get this question about why don't we practice metta on these retreats? And then sometimes people will say, there's no metta here. There's no kindness, which I don't often feel. I've never actually felt that there's no metta in the field of these retreats. Because actually, if we look at this quality of attitude, the attitude of the mind and heart, and we begin to explore really the nature of awareness, what is this quality of awareness? What does it truly offer? I know for me, as I continue to practice and deepen, there's this sense, this feeling that metta is really close to awareness, or that awareness is really close to metta. So awareness with, we could say, this attitude, wise attitude, that gets cultivated, that gets discovered, when the awareness is really rooted in a place that is accepting and allowing things to be just as they are. That's a kind of love, right? To really allow, let's say, our own heart and mind and body to be just as it is, that's not easy. It's actually difficult to walk around, even here where we don't have to do anything. Well, just one example of that, when Utejaniya actually was here and he was visiting the forest refuge, it is so quiet there. It's so quiet and so beautiful. And his nature is really like he's just like natural. He's not holding himself back and he walks around naturally. Even here, because it was so quiet, he was like, oh, I don't think I could teach like at the forest refuge. Because he felt like he started tiptoeing through the halls. And imagining Utejaniya tiptoeing is kind of a funny image for me because he's kind of the opposite of a tiptoeing type person. He kind of just saunters and swaggers and moves the body however it's going to move. And imagining him trying to like be careful because his message is so rooted in this invitation to be just as we are. Just as we are. And that's this place of wise attitude. That possibility of being as we are, like full permission to show up, which is kind of why I like to talk in a way that's a discovery. It's one way of giving a talk. It's lots of different forms. But I knew I had really found a teacher that for my nervous system, for the way I tended to try and get everything right and be perfect and, you know, and had so many years of that conditioning in school. I knew I had found the teacher I wanted to study with when I landed in Burma and at the monastery there. Didn't know anything really about him. Just one person had said one phrase to me in India. He said, oh, he's natural. I was like, natural. I like that. I like natural. That's really what I'm looking for. So I went there. I don't know when it was, but sometime in the first few days, I was sitting in the hall, and he would sometimes come in and talk or not. I didn't know what the rhythm was, but I was sitting there and then I heard his voice through the speaker. And he was talking and guiding. And then in these long pauses, I heard this kind of rasping sound. What's that? God, it sounds like sleeping. I was sitting some more and then, you know, hearing some more instructions after a few minutes and then after a period of time, some more kind of deeper, definitely snoring sounds. And at some point, and because there were two floors, I went downstairs and I was like, oh my gosh, he manages to fall asleep in between his instructions. That is remarkable. So he'd be guiding and just resting, and so resting, and the resting state is actually quite close to wise attitude and awareness, that he was that soft that he'd slip into some sort of deeper snoring. It's like, wow. And there's a lot of teachers whose aspiration it is, because they've known some teachers who can fall asleep while, let's say, giving instructions. It's like this shining star. It's like, oh no, I've made it. Well, if during an instruction I've managed, you know, to drift off. So here we are, most of us sitting and trying to stay awake, while as teachers we're trying to actually find that sort of deep ease and rest. Right? So attitude. So as much as wisdom, the wisdom factor, we could say is a little bit more cerebral, it's like up in the head. The attitude is really a descent into the heart, meaning it's relational. How are we relating to something? So when we say, and we're going to be dropping this in from time and again, to check your attitude, it's not a thinking move. It's really to begin to sense, how am I in relation to this experience? What is the dynamic? Is the hand kind of pushing against a door, trying to keep it shut? Like, are we closing something off? Are we holding on desperately onto something or wanting something to happen? Some expectation? And these dynamics, right, of wanting, of expecting, we don't realize it. But they are really draining. They tire the mind and heart. It's why it's actually very tiring to live a worldly life. Worldly meaning a mind that is filled with constantly needing the world to be slightly different than the way that it is. And this is a training. So when we sit and we begin to have moments of awareness, those moments of awareness begin to offer us the opportunity, as we settle in, to maybe sense some of these underlying patterns. And these patterns of reaching out, right, reaching out for something, pushing it away, these are the basic energies of greed and aversion, greed and resistance, and then delusion of not knowing. And the Buddha said these are the root causes. When we really look carefully into any moment of discontent, we'll find that. And again, this doesn't mean that the world isn't doing its own unskillful things. It just means that we, in our response to it, have the freedom to respond either with equanimity and wisdom and compassionate action, or we might respond with conditioned reactions of adding more fear, of anxiety, of uncertainty. And the whole world then just keeps spinning with this, these energies. Okay, so to check the attitude, what are we actually doing? Checking the attitude. Just want to use one example. This attitude that is hard to notice at first, but over time becomes clearer and clearer. So there's a time that when I was sitting in Burma, and I was ordained, so I was a monk at that time, and it's relatively probably some months into my being there. And during one of the sittings, my eyes, you know, happened to be closed, and just hearing this sound. Again, it was like not immediately identifiable, but it was like some sort of squeaking. Some of you may have heard me share this story before, but it was like a squeaking sound that was coming from somewhere in the hall. Like, oh, interesting. It has sort of a rhythm, like every minute the squeaking would squeak for a little while and then it would stop. I didn't know at that moment whether to be aversive or not, because it was kind of neutral. It's like, it's just a little squeaking, it's not too strong. Not a big deal. Then it would go away. But I could feel some interest. I was curious because it was a new sound. It sounded like a floorboard that was squeaking. It's like, yeah. But it has like a rhythm to it, like a squeak, 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 squeak. And then it would stop for a couple minutes. And then it would start up again. And I was really so curious. I was like, I don't want to open my eyes because I want to figure out what this sound is. I've been here for a long time, and that's not a sound that's like natural. So the curiosity was building, which was like an attitude of the mind. So curiosity was building. And during one of the moments that the squeaking was happening, I decided, okay, I can't figure this out. What is it? And I opened the eyes, and I saw that there was a monk standing on one of the floorboards, just standing still, back and forth, squeaking on this board. And then after about 5 or 10 squeaks, then he would keep walking. And he'd then, after he'd pause, and he'd come back, and he'd get to that squeaky spot again, then he would just do this thing, squeak, squeak. That created a lot of aversion. I was like, I'd understand if the boards are squeaky, that's fine. But to be intentionally standing on the squeaky board, like, what is wrong with you? What is that? Maybe you're enlightened and you're offering us this opportunity to work with really strong aversion. Maybe. So then my aversion came down slightly when I thought, okay, he is maybe trying to offer us this gift to work deeply with aversion. But then, of course, you know, he'd start walking again and he'd do this. What is he doing? And it was so wild to just watch my mind go through a whole cycle of reacting and being angry and upset, and then the mind would settle down. Okay, he's not going to do it again. He's done. He just spent hours. I mean, I was like, I don't understand, and I never asked him. And actually, he was didn't speak English, so there was no chance really to have that conversation, which was probably good for me to not know. And I'll never know, like, what was the true cause of those intentions. However, it offered me so much opportunity to look at the attitude. So before I knew what the sound was being caused by, there was just the hearing. It was very simple. Oh, yeah, that's just hearing. Then there was some interest, curiosity. There's a kind of attitude in the mind. And then there is an idea that it was bad. And that's where the judgment starts to come in. It's wrong. That experience of feeling the aversion towards this, you know, this sound, right? That was the experience of the aversion was so clear. It was like probably one of the clearest moments at that time that I'd had of just switching from not feeling much aversion to aversion and then out, back and forth. The sound was staying the same, but how I was relating to it was changing. And we can see then, depending on the lens that we have, you know, in our awareness, which is why the attitude, knowing the attitude is so important, depending on our lens, the world will look one way or another. So at some point with that experience with the monk, the real wisdom that came was, I don't know. I don't know what his intentions are. But I do know it's happening. And there are some causes and conditions in him, whatever they were, I really don't know, but whatever they were, there were some conditions that was causing him to make that choice. That wisdom, that understanding of just seeing it as nature, this being too is a process. And I could have, you know, skillfully, I could have gone up to him and said, Bhante, you know, made some sort of gesture, like, what's up? But I didn't need to do that, right? Because I knew, this is a sound, just a, like a bit of sound. I can deal with that. So the process of working with the attitude is first just even hear that there is an attitude that's worth checking in with. We can check. Anytime that we're struggling, I was talking with Susa earlier today about the idea of talking about attitude, and she said for her, which I love this way of sensing attitude, is like having walked in, this is if we're caught in an unskillful attitude, is like having walked into the wrong room, and things just sort of feel off. Having a moment or a day where things just don't feel right, or maybe it's a whole life, things don't feel quite right. So it's like, oh, what's going on here? In the wrong room, meaning there is some attitude that is playing out right now, some kind of aversion, some resistance, some wanting, some expectation, something I'm not allowing in to my heart, not allowing into awareness right now. And checking the attitude might reveal that. So now, in my own practice, anytime there's some kind of struggle or suffering, very naturally, there's a sensing into the attitude. What's being resisted? What expectation is there? What am I not allowing to be felt? What do I think shouldn't be happening? What view is underlying it? Some idea. So we check the attitude. Sometimes just by checking the attitude can shift. Just by recognizing or remembering, we could say, the view that this is nature. Whatever's happening is arising lawfully, out of conditions. Just some monk squeaking on a board. Just the pain in the knee, heartache. Right? So we might drop in the view, and sometimes the attitude can shift. So that is possible. By seeing the attitude, sometimes the attitude can shift. If that doesn't happen, which oftentimes is the case, then we simply learn about whatever is arising. We learn about the greed. We learn about the aversion. Right? This is really a path of learning, a path of insight. I used to have this chronic kind of contraction in my neck and throat, and it was so, I mean, still comes a little bit, but years and years and years, and I just thought, if this were to go away, I would be perfectly happy forever. It like got to that, it got that strong and bright and clear, like as an object. I watched it for so long, and it became really one of the strongest teachers for me to just watch all of the reactions around it. And eventually, I no longer was watching the kind of pain of it or the contraction and knot of it. And I really started just to turn towards the heart's reaction, the resisting it, the not liking it. I'm really curious about what is happening when I resist? And then when the resistance drops, and there's equanimity and kindness, what does that feel like? How does this not feel when there's equanimity? Is it different? When the aversion is bigger and more intense, how does this feel? When the identification with it is really strong, how does it feel? Right? When the identification drops and it's seeing it more as just vibrating energies and sensations, how does it feel? Right, so our process, whatever is happening, is inviting us into some understanding. Experience can be exactly as it is. Doesn't need to change. We don't need to be any better than we are. We have full permission, right, to be just as we are. And I know the habit is constantly to try and improve our experience. That's the tendency, right? That's the habit of the mind of wanting, right, of expecting, of hoping. Okay, so just to finish that last bit up, so we can first, just a reminder, if you're caught in something, just check, what is the attitude, what is the relationship? And this is going to bring us into direct experience. How am I relating? When we will learn to relate to our own heart, our own body, right, with our own thoughts, with this kind of attitude, naturally it emanates out. Right? It's a gift for others when we learn this process. So we check the attitude. We might be able to change it to an attitude that is more allowing and open, if we can. Typically, the attitude still stays stuck and aversive and reactive. So then we watch that, and we learn about aversion. We don't need to get out of it. If the aversion, if the craving is so strong that it's a storm, that's when we say, take care of the balance of the mind. Move the attention, do something. Let the energy of the mind and body find its balance again. So we don't ever need to be overwhelmed in our practice. We should always have some sense, right, that we're knowing about ourselves enough that we can skillfully be with what's happening. So if you're ever caught in something that feels so strong that checking the attitude or trying to work with the view doesn't kind of soften what's happening, then do something that brings the attention out of this vortex towards something that is more balancing. If you're sitting in the hall, it could be moving the body, it could be opening the eyes, could moving the attention to the hearing, right, looking around the room, standing. If it's really strong, just go for a walk. Right, just freeing up the energy, allowing the heart mind. Our sense of balance and ease, it's innate to our bodies. We've forgotten it, but the natural world shows us so many kind of ways of how to be just as we are. And yet through conditioning, you know, we have so many patterns of holding back, of contracting. And so this journey of listening, opening, learning to include more and more. It does take courage. Can't do it all at once, but it takes some willingness. And just that steady, steady moments of awareness. Just end with this last, in one of the groups today, someone was asking about one of the books of Sayadaw Utejaniya, and it's called Awareness Alone is Not Enough. And we were joking, I was like, I know. It's like hard enough to be aware, and now, like, there's this book, Awareness Alone is Not Enough. I was like, oh, you've got to be kidding me. Come on. I want it to be enough. Like, it's hard enough to be aware. But actually, awareness alone is not enough is partly pointing to this invitation of including the view and the attitude. And it actually helps to be able to attend to what is happening. When we have the view that whatever is happening is natural, that we can open to it over time, not all at once. We can open to it if it's difficult. It helps. We can be with the difficult. We can be with moods that feel stuck and grumpy. Oh, it's just an energy. Oh, I can be with that. And the awareness starts to open and include more and more and more. How are you doing? Aware? A little bit? How's your attitude? That's a hard question. Alrighty. So why don't we, let's just kind of close out. If you're not already kind of grounded in your experience, just taking a moment to remember where you are, if you've lost your body. Very ordinary. I know in my own practice, I couldn't be reminded enough that I was allowed to be just as I am. It was really the only time I was given that invitation was once I found the Dhamma, these kind of very generous and beautiful teachings. And giving ourselves permission to be just as we are and meeting it with some kind awareness. Allowing that to be enough. Thank you for your attention and for your practice today. We have some more moments to just be with whatever is coming up and moving, walking. And if you have energy for the last sitting, someone will be here to close out with you. Okay, wishing you a good rest of the evening.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.